From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on September 13, 1988, 2 months before the presidential election, roughly. Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis liked his chances, and he liked the polls. He was in relatively good position to defeat Vice President George H.W. Bush. And then a single photograph turned Dukakis into an object of ridicule for a little while and helped swing the momentum of the race. He would never get it back. That day, Dukakis' team arranged for a visit at the General Dynamics facility in Sterling Heights, Michigan. But it was more than just a meet and greet. Dukakis was going to get into a tank, a real one. He would put on a helmet and get up on an M1A1 Abrams main battle tank. The goal was to present an image to the electorate of a credible commander-in-chief. Dukakis staff member Matt Bennett told Politico that he can still hear the reporters laughing, all 90 of them. He says Sam Donaldson was laughing hardest of all. As the event wound down, one of Dukakis' traveling staff members approached Bennett and said, "Nice event. It may have just cost us the election." Indeed, that image accomplished exactly the opposite of what it was intended to do. And to this day, politicians remember it. Politico reports that earlier this year, President Obama was handed a Navy football helmet. He declined to put it on, saying, quote, "You don't put stuff on your head if you're president. That's politics 101, end quote. But in the political realm, the job is difficult for photojournalists. Almost everything is staged. Access has been cut over the years. How can they find so-called authentic moments? How can they deliver images to the public that offer value and context, especially during campaigns? My guests this hour are very well positioned to explain, and here for the entire hour, glad to have William Snyder, four-time Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer and chair of the photojournalism program at the Rochester Institute of Technology. William, welcome back.
Hi, thank you very much.
That Dukakis photo was I could have picked so many, Nixon on the beach, to me that was in the first one that I remember growing up and really seeing one single image that backfired. What do you remember about that one?
Well, that was exactly that. I mean, it was the first one. It was the sort of the beginning of the modern media age, and it was everywhere. And if I remember right, Bush used it in against him, and basically saying, "Look, he's an idiot. Look at this image of him," and it was on all the comedy talk shows. It was everywhere. It did not, as you said in your introduction, it did not have the effect that Dukakis' people wanted it to have. And I'm surprised they just let it go. Maybe they could have cut it short or something and limited the damage. But, with all the media there, just watching and laughing, that should have been some sort of message signal to them that they needed to cut this short and move on.
Well, and, but this wasn't the first and it has not been the last of a disastrous backfire when it comes to the failure of stage photo ops. I mean, we could talk about Nixon's stroll on the beach when he looked like, wearing a business suit on the beach, John Kerry windsurfing, George W. Bush standing in front of the Mission Accomplished sign. And time after time, these staged events, the public tends to see through things pretty well, I think. So why is it, do you think, William, that politicians and their staffs don't trust authenticity, or at least whatever nugget of authenticity would have? They're so controlling of the message. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, I think it's just people that don't understand imagery. And I mean, you pointed out things there. Those were all set up situations that their own people created for them, and they all backfired on them. And so instead of politicians and their handlers sort of understanding that and saying, every single image that we're familiar with where the candidate looks bad was something that was stage managed. Maybe we need to, let the pros do their job. That's never going to happen. People think they understand photography and imagery better than they do. We're inundated with it every day. It wasn't the same way 20 years ago, but especially now, they want to control every little thing. They're afraid that something bad is going to happen. And part of, for me, part of one of the arguments that I would make to those people, they won't listen to me, but would be, if you allowed this to happen more, your candidates would become more comfortable in front of the camera and they would be aware of it. And, they would do some their own self-policing, but they would become relaxed and you'd be able to get pictures where they look like normal human beings doing things. And I mean, I can't remember, and maybe there are, and maybe some of your listeners will remember, but I can't remember any natural pictures where the candidates look bad, except for, George Bush throwing up on people Gerald Ford falling down the stairs.
Yep.
You know, those are the only things that I can remember. Everything else, as you pointed out, they were all stage managed and poorly. And I think that's part of the issue, because the candidates, the politicians, whatever you want to call them, put themselves in the hands of the people that they trust. And so they're not self-policing, they're not self-aware, and they do dumb things. And so I think it would be much better off if they just learned to relax and let it happen.
Well, despite all those lessons of history, your colleagues who are, as William will tell you, you're not out taking pictures every day. You know, you're not working on the trail every day as you maybe had in the past. But I know you're still very connected to people.
Yes.
Who are working. And I want to read from an op-ed written for the New York Times by Santiago León, a longtime photojournalist. He's vice president and director of photography at the Associated Press. Someone that you know?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, he's a friend.
Here is what Santiago wrote about the Obama White House when it comes to access. Quote, "Manifestly undemocratic is the way Mr. Obama's administration, in hypocritical defiance of the principles of openness and transparency he campaigned on, has systematically tried to bypass the media by releasing a sanitized visual record of his activities through official photographs and videos at the expense of independent journalistic access." End quote. This is an administration that has really clamped down on access even more than previous, huh?
Absolutely. I think it says later in that article, or maybe it's in a different one, where it talks about the PR people said, the spokespeople said, well, we released more pictures than any other presidency before. Well, that's not the point. Those images are sanitized, even if it's the point where somebody says, well, we think it makes Michelle look heavy, or it makes, Barack look sort of, clumsy or something. I mean, even those little things, they make a difference. Let me put it this way. This administration has an amazing photographer working in it. His name is Pete Souza, and he's done a marvelous job. He's a tireless workhorse, but he's one guy. He's always there, and he's got people that work for him whose job is to pick the best pictures. Well, what are the criteria for the best pictures? I can't answer that because I don't work in the White House. I've seen really nice pictures that come out of there, and the access he has is unbelievable, but I can't help thinking, like Santiago does, that what are we missing? What aren't we seeing? And even if it's only little things, it creates opacity in the openness. If a neutral, quote unquote, third eye doesn't see it, how do we know? And that's the biggest thing. How do we know? And the people of the United States deserve to know. They don't deserve to just get stuff that comes directly from the candidate.
Well, here's a good listener question on exactly that subject. And as I get ready to read this email, listeners, you can email me, edawson@wxxi.org, as Carrie just did. I'm going to read her email in a second. You can find us on Twitter, @EvanDawson or @MMacMedia. Or you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Carrie writes to the program and just wants to know, does the White House Photoshop images before it puts them out?
No. Let's be clear about something. There is Photoshop and there is over-processing images. So what I will say is, yes, they do use Photoshop, I think. It's either Photoshop or Lightroom to color correct and get to make sure the exposure's right and all that. So yes, they do touch them. They don't come straight out of the camera and go out into the world. But do they manipulate them? Do they, remove things? Do they move things? No, the only time that they might do that is if it's in an office or something and there's sensitive material on a screen or on a table. They're going to blur that out, and I understand that. You would do that even if you were doing standard photography. What people need to understand about Photoshop and manipulating pictures, you can always do these things. It's just that Photoshop makes it easier. But I know most of the people that work in the White House, and they have the highest ethical standards as far as that's concerned. They don't, you know, when they set up pictures, they set up pictures and, you know, the grip and grins and things of that sort. But on the day-to-day basis, their job is to record history. You know, what would be interesting would be to see the raw takes of some of these things.
Sure.
I mean, that's how you can sort of edit these things. I have no doubt that all of these photographers, from Pete on down, he's got a staff of, I don't know, four or five people that work with him, and Michelle Obama has her own photographer, and, you know, and then people rotate in and out. I have no doubt that they have the highest ethical standards. I have no doubt that they shoot all of these other things, but it's what ends up out in the world. Now, you'll be able to find this stuff out when we have the Obama Library, and all of this imagery, you know, gets in there. You can do that for every president. You can go to their libraries, or you can hit up the photo libraries, and if you can get access to them, and I think there's a formal process if you have a legitimate reason, you can go and look at all the imagery. So in the archives, there's tons of negatives. Now there's tons of digital imagery, and now there's tons of video, because they're shooting video too.
Is Photoshopping unethical if you're releasing to the public?
No, I mean it's no more unethical than dodging and burning and cropping and doing things like that you would do on a silver-based image. I mean, even silver-based images, there was a transition period where we would shoot negatives, scan them in digitally, and then use Photoshop to do the same things that we did in a darkroom. There's a difference between toning and cropping and manipulating. I mean, you know, it's one thing to walk into a room and sort of make the lights in the room look the way they look to us, as opposed to the way they're recorded digitally or on film. And it's another to take those lights and make them black. I mean, that's changing the reality of what's there. Your eye sees the tonal range far, far better and differently than it's recorded either on film or digitally. Our eyes and our brains focus on certain things and bring up shadow detail and diminish highlight detail in a way that we can carry. I forget what the number is now. There goes my RIT education out the window. the tonal range that we can carry, let's just say, I'm not saying that's what it is, but let's just say it's 1,000 to 1. Well, a really good digital camera and really good reproduction will handle about 20 to 1, 50 to 1. And so you have to bring those things together.
Well, here's another take on this. Some people are posting their favorite. John just sent to the Twitter account on Twitter the picture of George W. Bush in front of the Mission Accomplished banner saying, "Never forget." Again, you talk about a backfire image.
Yeah.
And that's historic. But Laura writes to us and says, hold on a second, not Laura. Let me just pull this back up. Emma sends an email and just says, "Evan, is it possible that the Obama administration is so protective because he entered the White House with young daughters and any parent would be protective?" Well, I take that point, Emma, but they're not always at these events. Is that a stretch to you, William?
Well, yeah, I think it's a stretch because, you know, even the Obamas have talked about, you know, the girls don't spend much time in the Oval Office and they have dinner together every night, you know, away from all of this. When he works, I mean, excuse me. When he works, when he's on Air Force One, when he's out campaigning, when he's out making speeches, the girls aren't around, and it's not an issue.
And yet, it's still super sanitized and controlled.
Well, exactly. Again, in the piece that you read, it talks about how many times what the White House will do is they'll mark meetings, say with dignitaries or individuals, they'll mark them as private, and then that way the photographers don't get access to it. And 2 hours later, they'll release a bunch of pictures from that meeting. So how private was it? Where it used to be, at the very least, photographers would be ushered in the room. They'd have, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, shoot some pictures, and they would sit there and grip and grin or just smile at the cameras or wave or do whatever. And then the photographers would leave the room and they'd go on with their meeting. You don't even have that now. And I think part of that is just it's stage managing to the nth degree that does not need to happen. But let me – one of the things to think about, too, with Obama, he's a very personable guy, it appears. He's uncomfortable in front of the camera. The other night or a couple of weeks ago – Michelle Obama was on Stephen Colbert, and he showed a photograph of the two of them that actually looked very, very nice. It was kind of a silhouette of them.
Intimate moment.
Intimate moment. And what she said was she was actually saying, now whether this is true or not, she was actually saying, come on, cooperate with the photographer, you know, because the photographer took like 1 or 2 frames, and then Obama was like,
we're done.
You got enough. And she was like, no, give him a break. And so I think, you know, this is a man that has been in the office under public scrutiny for 8 years. And, you know, at that point, you should be more comfortable in front of the cameras. Now, obviously, Pete can do anything he wants because he's comfortable with Pete. You know, why couldn't he have established maybe not quite that intimate a relationship, but why couldn't he have established that relationship with some other photographers? That has happened throughout history. There are quite a few people. David Kennerly, David Burnett, who will be joining us later, P.F. Bentley, Stefan Savoia, all of these people were photographers that worked on the campaign trails and got to know the candidates and ultimately the presidents very well. And so they were comfortable having them around too. And there were other people that they became comfortable with because they got exposed to them and they got used to having them around and ignoring them in many, many ways. And I think that's one of the things that has happened with the Obama administration is whether it's all coming from him or whether it's a combination of him and the White House photo office wanting to limit access so they don't have to deal with it, so they don't have to, you know, either compete for imagery or deal with the logistics of it. I don't know. Or maybe it's a little bit of both. But, you know, and I have no doubt that if Hillary Clinton is elected, that it will be very, very tight with her,
oh,
too.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I remember the first time I covered an event with her when she came to Rochester. She came to RIT, it turned out. Mm-hmm. And we were instructed where we were allowed to stand. One of her advanced press folks said, you know, she's going to be walking around this corner. You can be right at the angle here. You can only get her coming this way. Then turn your camera off. And our guy said, I'm not going to turn my camera off. She's within view here. And she said, well, then, you know, then we're going to enter another way. And it was very, very controlled. And I would not be surprised if the next administration, if it's a Clinton administration, is very controlling as well. And Jim Borg of Reuters says it used to be much more freewheeling, which is exactly what William Snyder is telling us, with more access. But I do wonder, when do you think it really started to change? When was your observation, William, of when things started to get tighter when it comes to covering?
Well, I think it hasn't been an overnight thing. It's been, you know, just chipping away at it. And again, it depends on who has been in the White House and sort of what they do. I'll give you an example. When Clinton was running for election the first time, he was really very, very accessible. Again, some of those people that I mentioned earlier, Stefan and PF and David and numerous others, traveled with him and worked with him very, very closely. They got to be, you know, as friendly as you can be in those situations and trusting and accepting. Well, then when he got into the White House, they kind of clamped down on everything. There was a short list of very, very good people to be the White House photographer. Stefan was on that list. PF might have been on that list. I don't remember. And a few other people. But then when it came down to it, they hired somebody totally different. And boy, the access and the imagery just kind of went away. W was a little bit better. He was a little more accessible than they had been. I worked in Dallas during a large portion of W's tenure, and we managed to get some access to him that, you know, that other people didn't get. But there were photographers that were able to kind of do the day in the life kind of deal. But certainly not the kind of access that some people had had during Reagan mm-hmm. and some people had during the first Bush and all of that. And then we have Obama. Again, it's great photography that's coming out of there. I mean, even W had Eric Draper, and Eric Draper is an amazing photographer. And for the first term, Mike Davis was the chief editor, and they came up with great imagery, but you know, letting people in from the outside began to tighten up a little bit, and then it basically shut the door during Obama.
Should the person who set up the Mission Accomplished banner photo op, should that person have been out of a job?
I think so. I mean, you know, again, that's part of the deal is, you know, why? What are they thinking of? What are they talking about? I mean, that was one of the things that actually helped Clinton. Clinton's people were very, very good at making the, as they call them in the business, the optics really good. And that was one of the things that sort of helped them. They understood the power of photography. They understood the power of video. And, you know, and they during the campaign, they let enough access happen that, you know, you learned all this stuff about Bill and Hill, and you began to like them somewhat, you know, unless you're on the other side and you hated them. But, but then when people really started to manage this stuff that didn't know what they were doing, you see the results. They're disastrous.
Let me grab a phone call. One result, by the way, is when Al Gore was chosen for vice president, the Clinton team said, hey, this would be great to show your youthful vigor. Go out for a jog together. First of all, their outfit for the jog wasn't all that appealing. Second of all, the second stop on their jog was McDonald's, which Phil Hartman as Clinton lampooned to no end on SNL. So there's another photo op that...
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Let me grab Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, I want to bring to mind this one photograph that I just dearly love, and then I want to make a point about it. And that was the one that we've seen so often of JFK, busy at important work, and a camera pans down or the photographer steps back, and you see John coloring under the desk. And that is the most lovable photograph to me. And it shows some sort of comfort. But my what I want to say is that when things change somewhere, is it possible that the candidate himself had more say on what would be photographed and how? And then later on, maybe it became the job of a manager, as you say, because I see in some of these photographs of, you talk about Dukakis and Kerry, a sort of a stereotypical thinking of what's cool, you know, surfing mm-hmm. or being in the tank, as opposed to who that person really was. But my all-time favorites are with JFK. I also want to point out that movie, The Candidate, was released in 72, so somebody already felt strongly that there was a problem mm-hmm. in the managed photos of candidates and so forth. Thank you. I like your reaction to that.
Yeah, thank you, Jane. And it wasn't just 1972. 1927, President Calvin Coolidge was warned, do not put feathers on. He wore a headdress while being named an honorary chief in Deadwood, South Dakota. And that awful picture of him wearing feathers was another one. So you're right, Jane. It goes back decades and decades. But go ahead, Bill.
Well, I think, you know,
William, why do I always want to call you Bill?
Because that's what everybody calls most Williams.
Bill. Go ahead,
as my mother loudly said across the first newsroom that I worked in when I was 14, I named him William. He's not Bill.
Go ahead.
I was humiliated very early on about that. Anyway, I don't think... I just think it was a different time. You know, back in those days, I mean, think about general access. I mean, you know, there's that great picture of Robert Kennedy on the hood of a car kind of going down the street and during a parade slash rally for him. Something like that would never happen now. You know, access to the Oval Office has tightened up a lot. When I first started working in 1981, there was a lot of access to that and to all the candidates. I mean, I have pictures from when I was a student here at RIT of George H.W. Bush that I shot with a wide-angle lens from 3 feet away during the campaign. I have pictures of Gerald Ford that I shot when I was in high school, you know, where I wandered around the entire hall and could basically shoot what I wanted to, except right down front. You just, for whatever reason, there are people that have decided that this managing is of the media is more important than actually letting them do their job. You know, I hate to say this, and I've said this in the past, and people always get mad, but the media is sort of like, you know, dogs with a bone. If you take it away from them, they're going to kind of come after it, and maybe not in a good way. If you pet them and you give them access and you let them do their jobs, 9 times out of 10, they're not going to bite you. And I don't understand why more people don't get that. I mean, think about this. One of the things that's galling for us in the business right now is if I can get a ticket to a candidate's rally, I can go in and I can shake their hand and I can photograph them from 2 feet away. But if I'm an official member of the press, I'm stuck in a pen 100 feet away and can't see anything. And, you know, there used to be a time where the Secret Service, and some people knew it and some people didn't, actually used the press as part of their shield around the candidates, because there were people that they had vetted, they knew, they understand them, and so they used them as part of that barrier. And now it doesn't exist. And it's sort of like there's no logical justification for keeping us out. There really isn't. Because if you let people get in there and touch the candidate and be in the candidate's face, you know, they can't have 50 or 60 of us in there. But political candidates and presidential tours have always had what they call pool, and the tight pool. So it's like one or two, you know, still photographers and a video person and maybe a word person, and they get, you know, right up close and get that access and then share their imagery and their notes with everybody else. I don't understand why you can't continue to do that.
Talking to William Snyder, who is a four-time Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist and the chair of the photojournalism program at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Want to get our only break of the hour and come back and welcome David Burnett, who's an award-winning photojournalist for more than 5 decades of work covering politics, war, and a lot more. And by the way, just so I don't get accused of, well, it doesn't matter. Listeners accuse me of something every day. But I did mention that I think Hillary Clinton, if she's the next president, yes, I think it's going to be a tight clamp on access from the media, whether it's reporters, photojournalists, and more. That's been their history. But Donald Trump said last night at a rally, not really seeming to joke that much, that he would like to have veto power over journalists. And given his discussion on how he thinks libel law should be made looser, I would not put it past him to see something even more sinister. So let's get our only break of the hour and come back with both William and David Burnett next. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about Jon Stewart's draft. The former host of The Daily Show says it's time to bring back the draft, but not necessarily a military compulsory draft. He's talking about turning 18 and having to spend 1 year mandatory service to your community or the country in some way. That means more volunteering, more work with local organizations. Can it work? We'll talk about it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, talking to William Snyder, who is a 4-time Pulitzer-winning photojournalist. And I want to bring in David Burnett, who's a photojournalist with decades of work covering presidents and politicians and so much of the American fabric of life. And David, it's wonderful to have you on the line. How are you?
Thank you. And let me just say, I'm a zero-time Pulitzer Prize winner, just so we get it straight.
Four, nothing.
It's interesting. The numbers start to really boggle the mind. But, you know, the king of Thailand died yesterday. The very first time I went to the White House was in July of 1967. I had a summer job, what I guess would now be called an internship with Time Magazine. And half of that time was in New York, and the other half was spent in Washington. And the first day I got there, Wally Bennett, the Time Magazine staff photographer, put this 20-year-old kid and said, well, we're going to the White House. And the event that we went to cover was the King of Thailand having an official state visit with Lyndon Johnson. And I don't know, it's 49 years ago and a half, I guess, because it'll be next summer, that'll be 50 years. It's gone by in a hurry, but it's, as I just picked up on the last few minutes of what William Snyder was saying, and it's true, I also once tried to call him Bill. That didn't work. But it's true, and just listening to you guys talking about it, I think what strikes me is that we're looking at the definitive victory of higher education's public relations programs over journalism programs. That's really what's happened. You have all these kids that decided to go into PR and to communications and communications management and political communications. Many fewer probably in journalism at the same time. And while the journalists are trying to claw up that mountain of access, the people at the top of the Alamo Wall pushing the ladders back over with the photographers on it, are all those people that went to school to learn how to be PR mavens and try and control their image. And that ultimately is what everybody thinks they should do, is to have control, control, control. And I think, unfortunately, that we're kind of living in that era. And then combining that, I'm going on and on here, but I'll make two points and then shut up. But the fact that in the last 8 years of the arrival of Obama, who was using the internet in the way no one had before to get elected, and then they realized they could go end runs around Andrea Mitchell and Bill Plant and go directly through their own media, or at least they thought they could. I mean, the people that go on whitehouse.gov, who actually does that? I don't know. Maybe some people do. But it gave them a feeling of control. And you saw just in the 8 years of the most transparent White House ever, quote unquote, you're seeing a vastly decreased number of events available to the press. And the president's photographer, Pete Souza, who's a great guy and a great photographer, but his job is to provide imagery for the White House and to be disseminated by the White House as if it were a PR campaign. And the whole concept of the value of a independent press just keeps getting chipped away at every turn, whether it's the Trump White House or the Clinton White House. I don't think in either case is it going to be very good. Now, if Bill Weld were vice president, that would probably be something else. He's a pretty reasonable guy, but nothing good on the horizon from what I can see.
Yeah, and to the point on the number of people in PR versus journalism, I would be speaking out of school without looking up the numbers, though I am convinced I've seen a number of cases, and maybe Megan Mack, producer, can help me flesh this out. I think more people are graduating with PR degrees than journalism degrees. We've certainly seen newsrooms cut number of staff. We've seen newsrooms cut number of people in photojournalism or video journalism. You know, when I was in commercial television news, this was a constant discussion on, well, the new graduates have to be jack of all trades. And the old saw about jack of all trades, master of none came up. I do remember a conversation with a news director, and I said, look, I can learn to do a lot of things. I can white balance a camera, but you're never going to get high quality images or video out of me. And I don't think that's what we want to dump on the public. And the response was, well, you know, people can take video and pictures with their cell phone, and we can use YouTube. And I said, if that's the standard, I think the public is going to be injured.
It's amazing how when you see, you know, in the, like 10 years ago when, like, it was a big deal when the Dallas paper got rid of their cameras and they gave everybody video cameras and they wanted, you know, it's like, like, wow, we're all standing in line so we can watch more lousy video. Like, there isn't enough lousy video already on television. We just need crap. And we've kind of definitely segued into the world of good enough. And it's, you know, excellence has been replaced by good enough in almost every Bean Counters annual assessment of what that particular news agency or organization has to do. And you end up with a situation where, you know, occasionally a reporter with a cell phone might actually make a good picture. It's probably rare, but it will happen. But it sort of proves the point that the public is at this place where they're, you know, they'll just take whatever comes flying by, and there's so much stuff in the pipeline that if you just take a breath, you'll have a whole other dump truck's worth of stuff in about 5 minutes, and then you won't have to worry about the crap that you just saw. They'll have new crap.
Well, let me just jump in and say, ask and you shall receive. Megan Mack, thank you for this. Pew Research finds that the PR field has expanded to a degree that these specialists now outnumber journalists by nearly 5-1, and a top reason is the pay gap. PR professionals are paid more, the average gap around $20,000 a year more to work in PR than journalism these days. And so, yeah, that certainly is the case. I would also say I am not naive about the fact that everyone does have an ability to capture images. And if there's a breaking news situation, if there is, you know, yesterday we saw a plane crash in Connecticut, in Hartford, in East Hartford. You know, those are the moments where someone grabs an image or a piece of video, and maybe that's useful. But if that's if you're going to rely on that exclusively, that is a real detriment, and I think you're missing.
No, I mean, there will be definitely be times when being there is the only thing that matters. I mean, if you remember about 4 or 5 years ago, there was a woman flying on a commercial flight to South Florida to do a job interview. And out her window, she happened to see a shuttle launch up in Cape Canaveral, about 100 miles away. And it made the most striking image of this little contrail rising out of the clouds. And she shot it with her iPhone. I think gave it to the AP. She might have made $10 or $15 for it. And it went everywhere. And sometimes there just is going to be somebody with a camera who's there, a non-professional. But I think all of that, to me, and I'm sure Mr. Snyder would agree that this, it only reinforces the necessity for understanding that a professional core of journalists and photographers is even more important now than perhaps it ever was.
Well, you know, when you say that, David, I think I've said it in sitting in this very chair before, and I'm going to say it again to everybody that's out there. Everybody can take a picture in the exact same way that everybody can write. That doesn't make you a photographer. It doesn't make you a writer. I mean, photography in and of itself has become democratized just like writing has. But you don't know how to tell a story. You don't know how to repeat what you've done. You don't know how to do it on demand. That does not make you a photographer. Talking about the industry, what I've always found striking is that the photography and the imagery is sort of the first to get cut in newsrooms. And there is this notion that writers need to learn how to take pictures. Well, why can't the best journalists learn to do what they're not naturally strong at? So why can't the best journalistic photographer learn to write better? Because their writing is going to be at least as good as the best photograph that a writer can produce.
Taken by a writer. Yeah.
Exactly. And maybe better because, you know, when many times the big difference now between writers and photographers is, look, we still have to be there. We have to be in front of the situation. We actually see what's going on. Many times, writers are sitting in offices and they're getting things off the phone and off the wires and off the television. They're not actually there. So, yes, they may be trained observers, but the way it's practiced now isn't the same, which brings us all back to exactly where we started with, you know, political and campaign imagery. If we're not there to document what happens, you know, is what's going on? You know,
this is what I think has been one of the unfortunate things about what the Obama White House has tried to do, which is to really limit these little events. As if there, and I'm sure there was this whole thing, you know, it's like not really quite rise to the level of conspiracy, but it really does tick me off because you have at some point there was a meeting with a bunch of senior people at the White House sitting around, and this had to have been a discussion at which somebody said, well, you know, we don't really need these meetings. The Pete can put the pictures out, and we don't need to let all these, you know, the photographers in. And they went, you know, for these little sort of a bill signing or like the equivalent of the Turkey Day pardon kind of thing. But when you have a great core of photographers, as the White House photography core is, even these little moments, these little events can give you an eye into the president in a way that pretty much no writer is going to do. And all of that has been lost and kind of replaced with official, very good pictures by Pete. And what really ticks me off in the whole ebb and flow of this thing is that you have somebody like David Axelrod, who was senior counselor to the president. I don't know what his exact title was. He was there for 6 years, and who had to have been in that meeting. And then he comes out of the White House and is immediately hired for $1 zillion a year by CNN. Now he's just back to being a political guy, reporting on politics with a favorable thing toward Obama and the Democrats and so forth. No one has ever said to David Axelrod, so David, were you in that meeting? Were you the guy who thought it was a really good idea to cut down on these photo ops? Like, you know, it's like we're our own worst enemy. And, of course, television, if I can quote Senator Warren, who was speaking about the Wells Fargo president, they're gutless leaders. And unfortunately, they have all the money and all the sway. So we're just kind of stuck in the afterwake of what happens with big media, whether it be social media, and why anybody cares about Twitter lighting up, I can't tell. That's how out of it I am. I have a Twitter account. I tweet. But, like, what? Who cares if Twitter lights up? So what? Like, let somebody in and take some pictures. Come on.
Well, before we lose the hour, there's a couple other themes I want to hit here with our two guests. Our two guests are it's 4-0 in Pulitzers. That is true. William Snyder's got the edge, 4-0. But David Burnett is
a
photojournalist.
Ask him how he did at World Press.
Yeah, exactly. He's got everything else.
Yeah,
that's all I have.
David Burnett's a photojournalist with plenty more to say in the way of awards. So. There's no slouches on this, with the exception of me. I could barely photograph my way out of the paper.
Did you hear just the news today that Bob Dylan got the Nobel Prize for Literature?
Yeah.
So there is hope for all of us.
Yeah, know? That's right.
Yeah.
So I know David Burnett had mentioned that whether it's Trump or Clinton, we're not headed for probably a more open area when it comes to media access. You wanted to say something about Trump.
What I wanted to say about Trump is, I mean, not only is it not going to be more open, I think it's going to be openly hostile. I mean, he's already done that at many, many rallies where he turns
right.
the crowd on the media pin and has on numerous occasions specifically pointed out the photographers. You know, he doesn't understand what they're supposed to do. And, you know, and there was one particular one, but I have no doubt that it's happened since then, where he says, you know, why aren't you looking at this? Why aren't you looking at that? Because there are people in that pen, their job is to just stay on him in case anything happens. I hate to put it this way, but that's sort of this death watch thing. Somebody attacks, somebody comes up. That's why we have the stuff that we have, because there are people that all they do is focus on him. They are not supposed to look anywhere else. But, you know, and at the you know, I no longer work for news media anymore, so I can say this. That's the problem with an idiot like Trump. He does not understand what the job is, and it doesn't conform to what he thinks it should be. So he criticizes.
And he doesn't really understand the value of a free press either. That's pretty clear.
Oh, he doesn't want free press.
Yeah, he has been hostile to press. We had a separate hour on this program with attorneys who work in libel law, just helping us understand just how. Well, look, the president couldn't get in on day one and peel back libel law or change it, but he could certainly try, and he's made it clear that he would try. Before we lose the hour, I wanted to ask William and David, I'll start with you, this idea that if access were more open, or at least back in the days when you had better access, you know, you've covered a number of presidents. How do you go about the process of trying to decide what's an... This is such a strange word, but an authentic image or a valuable image? And here's one thing that I'm thinking of in recent days. We saw that event where... Barack Obama and Michelle Obama and George W. Bush and Laura Bush were together in an event, and George W. Bush had this tender moment with Michelle Obama. She came over, put her arm around him. He kind of leaned his head into her shoulder. And if you saw it on video, it was nice. The image gave it a little bit more permanence. The singular image froze that moment, which was less than a second long, and made it look like this really warm embrace that I think some people, I actually thought the video did show tenderness too, but some thought, well, the image doesn't do justice to what actually happened because the video shows it was more fleeting. How do you make sure that what you're presenting is, you know, genuine and accurate, whatever word you would use to describe it?
Well, I would say that the still picture really boils the situation down to its essential. If you look at Nick Ut's picture of Kim Phuc, the little napalm girl on the road in Vietnam, mm-hmm. if you look at Eddie Adams' picture of Colonel Lawan shooting the Viet Cong prisoner, all these photographs have accompanying TV footage that goes with it. The TV footage treats every moment equally. And the still picture is the distillation of what the peak of that moment is really all about. And very few times will you ever see, I can think of a plane going into the World Trade Center, for example, when you, especially that you know it's coming when you see that video. But in most situations, the still picture will win out over the video image simply because there is a key moment at which the composition, the emotion, everything comes together in that still picture. And I'm sure of almost all the pictures that both William Snyder and I have shot that ever were given a prize for anything, there will be an accompanying video or television footage which will be decidedly less interesting than the still picture. And that's really what still photography does. That's why photography remains, I believe, even in this age of tweeting and video on your phone, a very powerful tool.
Well, and the other thing is you have the ability to sit there and just look at it. I mean, in this day and age of...
You control it.
Exactly. Yeah. In this day and age of people clicking through pictures and things flying at you, the ability to just sit there and look at something and sort of study it, it's really, really important. I mean, and I think we've lost a little bit of that. Excuse me. I have to work with my students all the time and tell them to slow down, both when they're looking at pictures and when they're making pictures, and to look for those little moments because, you know, it's like acting. I mean, think about acting. When you look at great actors, the more subtle they are and the more real they are, the more you feel. When it's big and bombastic, and in our case, it moves and it's got sound and all that, it doesn't affect us as much.
Yeah, overacting only. Al Pacino only gets so far with the overacting. So, hey, I'm against my better judgment. I'm going to squeeze in one more phone call. But Dave in Fairport, you got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay, I have two comments. One is, you guys are doing an awful lot of complaining. And
yeah.
I'd like to hear something that we can do as a listening public that is positive in the direction that you're talking rather than just hearing the complaints. The second is, I wonder how much of the limitation in access is due to the number of just negative commentators and pictures that we're bombarded with over various news outlets and pseudo-news outlets.
All right, Dave, I got to jump in and say that second part I don't think is a valid critique. If the White House doesn't like the commentaries or columns, this is a free press, and that's too bad. But on the first one, it's a good question. William, how would you answer that? What can we do?
Well, I mean, look, if the people out there, if you write your congressman, if you send emails to the White House and saying we want more access, we want to see more, that's the only way this stuff is even remotely going to get fixed, because we've all complained. I mean, Santiago wrote that editorial, and there were something like 50 or 60 signees to a thing that was sent to the White House from major news organizations. And what happened? Nothing.
Yeah, yeah. David, 20 seconds. What do you think?
Well, it's true. I mean, the only thing that the politicians listen to are the barks of the public and their constituents. So, you know, I, on the other hand, I kind of wish there was an easier way to just sort of see the best pictures of the day and go to, like, I don't know if there is some place where you can, you know, do good pictures just automatically rise to the, slowly to the top and become more viewable? It's certainly video tends to, that tends to happen, but I think with still pictures, sometimes it takes you a while even to get to where you can find the good pictures. And I, you know, I don't know what the answer is to that, but you know, it's photography is still powerful, and we gotta stay with it for at least another generation, I believe.
Well, David, thank you. DavidBurnett.com. Check out his stuff, and thank you so much for the time, David.
Sure.
A Pulitzer in honor for David, or for William Snyder, four Pulitzers himself, chair of the RIT's program on photojournalism. Always a pleasure. Thank you, William.
Thank you very much.
All right, short break. More connections next.